We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Terry Diabolic, finger on the pulse. DJ Never Forget is off gallivanting in California. That was just Pocket Vinyl, who is going to be our musical guest today on Snacky Tunes. And the name of that song was Quiet Epiphany. Welcome to Snacky Tunes Pocket Vinyl.
Thanks.
Yeah, we try and get everybody like mid-sip or mid-bite just right. When we introduce them. But you guys are going to be playing a little bit live, not painting,
no,
which painting was what you normally do, but...
We were thinking actually at first of having her paint like during the food guest, and then like finished up while we were doing the songs, but we decided against that.
No. All right, it's fine. No problem.
If you don't mind.
No problem. And our food guest today is... can we say Brooklyn native now?
We can.
How many years have you been in Brooklyn?
Just 5.
That's enough. Tyler Boring, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
So Tyler, let's talk about your origins. You know, you may recognize Tyler's unique name, if not from Top Chef, but let's go back to the beginning a little bit. You grew up in Kansas City, right?
Yeah, born and raised.
And how did that shape your culinary outlook?
Well, Kansas City is all about some of the best barbecue in the nation. So I started off eating really great food from the get-go. And that had a huge impact on my later cooking career. I also grew up with a Japanese nanny. So that had a huge impact, too, kind of taking me in some Asian directions.
I don't think I've ever met anyone with a Japanese nanny.
Well, my dad was raising me by himself. So while he was at work, this Japanese woman took care of me. And she made me kind of... very traditional Tokyo-style pub food and a lot of it. And
which is, for our listeners who don't know the ins and outs of Japanese pub food, what does that consist of?
Maybe a lot of, like, sort of fried, heavy ramen-y, pork katsu, chicken katsu, teriyaki sorts of affairs.
So all the good stuff that's popular now.
Yeah, all the good stuff that's popular now was kind of how I was raised up. That was some of my comfort food along with Kansas City-style barbecue. So... you know, I started off eating right.
When did you know that you were going to cook and you wanted to be a chef full-time or be involved with food?
I always enjoyed cooking from the get-go. It was always something I really looked forward to. And then when I was 16, my first job was flipping hamburgers at Sonic. And I guess that was such an amazing experience for me, making Frito pies and chili cheese dogs, that I just really wanted to take that to the next level.
Did you ever experiment with Sonic, or was it pretty rigid in the menu?
The menu itself was rigid, but when we were making personal food for ourselves, we definitely came up with some stellar concoctions, which sometimes I feel like I see them pull out as like a special sort of treat on the menu.
Yeah, you gotta, I'm sure.
Not that we have Sonic here in New York, but.
No, but we have Sonic commercials, which I never understood.
There's a Sonic in New Jersey, like right. 45 miles away or something
right,
like that.
Right, the one Sonic.
Yeah.
So after you put in your time behind the grill at Sonic, where's your next move in the world?
Went to British Columbia, did a bread baking internship, went to Park City, Utah, cooked some Italian food as a chef's apprentice, ended up in Seattle, and used Seattle as a home base for 10 years to make a lot of global stops. Went to chocolate and pastry school in Paris, apprenticed all through Denmark, and also apprenticed through Thailand. Really put some frequent flyer miles on my belt with my knives.
No, that sounds right. Now, when you were over in Denmark, was the, I guess, what's now become probably one of the most famous new cuisines to the world, was that already happening, or were you there before the Noma and everything hit?
I was there before Noma and everything hit, but the seeds of that whole genre of cooking could be seen throughout Denmark and had a huge impact on my early cooking career, sort of hyper-localvore sorts of ideas, and using things that were incredibly local was all thoughts that I encountered in Denmark back in the late 90s. And those were really revolutionary and fundamental towards pushing me along my career.
Now, at what point did your, I guess, current outlook on food and how you wanted to cook start to coalesce? When did all these small different influences of Thai food or Danish food or Asian food start to come together?
I think it's been just sort of a lifelong process that I've just been adding to bit by bit. And it's through these very rich experiences I've had in travel with sort of local people and really having a one-on-one experience with the local cuisine that's helped me take my cuisine to these all these different levels. And it's with those relationships as well, combined with those travel experiences, that that's what shaped my career. And
when did you make that ultimate decision to come to New York?
I was living in Chicago 6 years ago working for the Kimpton Hotel and Restaurant Group, and they had me coming here for business anyways. A position opened up and I jumped at it.
And what restaurant was it, or what was the position?
I was just an executive sous chef for the company, solving problems here and there. We had a lot of problems at some of our venues in New York, and I would come help them out. And
what's it like being a New York or a chef in New York? Like, did you love it? I mean, was the lifestyle what you had thought it was going to be, or did you think it was just extremely crazy?
I probably learned more about cooking, and my skills advanced more in the first 2 years I was here than in the previous 16 years of my career anywhere in the world. This is the most competitive environment in the world for what we do, and I've never encountered such an amazing convergence of ideas and thoughts about how to do things differently, how to have different takes on things, and you really learn from the other chefs that are here, kind of pushing the envelope farther than it is anywhere else in, I would say, the United States.
Now, it's a real community. I mean, like, everyone has a real varied background, and now as more and more people get into cooking, I mean, what are the groups of people that really, like, come together, and does it really come together, or is there still, like, different factions within, you know, the New York cooking scene?
I guess you could say there are different factions, but, I mean, a lot of what you have going on is, okay, so you have, like, the intense localvore movement, and mm-hmm. you have different degrees of that from, you know, people working the rooftop farms and harvesting moss out of Central Park to then you also have, you know, Team Modern, people kind of mm-hmm. pushing the envelope with gels and foams and amazing plate presentations. And then you have, you know, other groups of people. You have super high-end fine dining, super casual neighborhood places. But, I mean, I feel like everyone does come together on the premise of what really matters is making great food.
Mm-hmm.
And what tastes good.
Now, you have an idea, a concept about bringing barbecue and Kansas City barbecue to a city that, I guess with probably dinosaur barbecue about 10 years ago or more than that, has really started to see a rise in that. So what makes you want to bring another restaurant, like another barbecue restaurant, to New York City?
I think that Kansas City style barbecue is very underrepresented in the New York City area. There's only two real restaurants that tout to be of Kansas City style. And I feel like there is just a huge appreciation for obviously pork and pork belly
yes. Yes.
in the New York City area. And with that, you would definitely love ribs and pork butt and Kansas City is also really known for burnt ends and really great, mm-hmm. like, well-cooked briskets. And it's dry-rubbed, smoked long and slow overnight, usually over hickory and oak, and then finished with kind of a tomato molasses-y, sometimes spicy barbecue sauce. And I don't know, I think doing that right would be something that New Yorkers could really appreciate and take with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everybody's still looking for their go-to barbecue spot in New York City. I don't think there's one like, oh, if you want barbecue, you have to go there. Because they're all so different, and each of them, in my mind, have their, I don't know, disappointing qualities at some level. I mean, sometimes the only disappointing qualities that's just a pain in the ass to get to. Like, I love Daisy Mays, but going to, you know, Midtown on the Super West Side or going up to Harlem, you know, it's there's no, like, central local good place.
But that's also the same sort of ideologies that run through Kansas City style barbecue.
Yeah.
Because if you go into Kansas City and you ask Kansas Cityans, oh, what's your favorite barbecue? And everybody's like, well, I like to go to Gates for ribs, but I only go to LC's for the burnt
right.
ends, and the beans are really good at this other place, or, you know, we should try something else. But everybody's got their, like, here and there. So I mean, that's kind of what happens in barbecue culture.
Yeah, it's always, there's no place that does it all the best. Well, not yet.
Not yet.
All right, so we're gonna take a quick musical break, and then we're gonna come back. We'll talk about Top Chef. We can't talk about a few things, but we'll talk about the things that you can't talk about.
Watch what happens.
Watch what happens, and then being an out chef in the chef community, and about what that's like, and the I guess the history of gay men in New York cooking, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. So this track coming up is going out to Flostradamus. Total Recall, the hit number one on Hype Machine. With this one, here you go. Love the Flostradamus guys. Super awesome. Total Recall is the track. Number one Hype Machine. And if you want to check out Kurt, DJ Autobot Flostradamus, he was on the last show of last year. And this is the first show of this year. And we have Tyler Boring. How did you get that name? Is that your real name?
Tyler Boring is my real name, but the way that it's spelled was one of my chefs about 15 years ago changed my name to that spelling. And then I lived in Denmark. And it kind of stuck.
Huh. All right. It's good.
Yeah.
It's tough to Google.
It
Googleability is tough.
Googleability is tough, but if you just type in T-Y-L-O-R, it usually comes out.
Yeah. So let's talk about your run on Top Chef this season. You got immunity in last week in the barbecue.
I did. I won the Modernist Cuisine Challenge as well.
Which must have been that who's that guy on there? The guy from Modo. Who's always talking about being modernist cuisine, who's always and never seems to be able to pull it off.
Chef Chris Jones is an amazing modernist cuisine chef in Chicago. Great guy.
Yeah.
A lot of amazing techniques. Learned a lot from that guy this summer.
So talk to us about the experience of being a top chef and how much is it is really about the cooking and how much is it about just the, you know, reality television?
The show is all about cooking, and it's an amazing collection of some of the most talented chefs, I'd have to say, in the country. And everything that you see is exactly the way that it happens on the show. I mean, we're really timed, and Padma's really there kind of counting down, and they're actually really judging your food. And it's a very difficult and challenging experience to cook so fast and under such circumstances.
And what's it like to really put it all on the table, on the line, and then have a bunch of people be like, oh, this sucks? Just, like, in you know.
Well, I really think that's no different than opening a restaurant here in New York City and being judged by all of the 8 million people that live in New York City. I mean, you're really putting it out here as well. And I think it's kind of amazing because there are very few times in your life, at least one of the most amazing parts of being on the show was there's never a time in your life where the only thing that you have to get up and do is worry about making your art or making your craft.
Yeah.
And when you're on the show, you really don't have to worry about any of that. And so you can really just do your best and put it out there. And it's good to be judged. It's nice to hear that critical feedback, even if it's hurt, you know, even if it hurts your feelings or whatever. I mean, that's the way it is. And everything the judges usually have to say is spot on, and it's great advice. And it's very good for a chef to hear that kind of feedback and use that to grow. I mean, or you can go cry in your corner, but I mean, you know, it's good to hear that feedback, and it definitely caused me to grow even more as a chef.
I mean, it's never seemed personal with the judges to the chef testants. Did I say that right?
Yes, chef testants. Yes, yes.
I know that, you know, obviously things will happen between people competing, but there's never been a moment where you go, well, that seemed a little personal.
That's what I try and remind my staff too at the restaurant when I'm working, is that this isn't personal. It's just about the food. It's about the experience. And I think that's an important thing to remember on the show. And it definitely was not personal.
And let's talk about the, I guess now that you've been on the show and people are recognizing you, you said that some woman had a little bit of a freak out on you at Whole Foods in a positive way.
In a positive way, but yes, people have definitely started to spot me on the subway or maybe shopping for dinner at Whole Foods, things of that nature. So those have been unique experiences. I went to Anthony Bourdain's restaurant a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people there recognized me, and it was just sort of a funny moment.
And have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, it's been great, and being on the show has definitely helped me to be able to rally support to gather investors to open my own restaurant here in New York City. So,
now, I know that in seasons past, they've made a big thing about having gay contestants and things like that, but this year, they haven't even mentioned it at all.
They've mentioned it very briefly on the show. They outed me, I think, 4 or 5 episodes in.
But I mean, there are times when
it was a 10-second clip, so you either heard it or you didn't. So,
and you were saying on the break that like being gay in the chef community is not, it's not an issue. It's a non-issue or an issue that people would, you know, it's sort of just come to job, do your work,
but also I've kind of always just been myself, and I mean, being a chef is really about cooking, and so it's just about putting your own life aside and making really great food. And if you make really great food, it doesn't matter if you're gay, straight, Mexican, American, French, whatever. As long as you put your food where your mouth is, people don't really care.
Yeah. But you know, there is a proud tradition, especially in New York with James Beard and a lot of the original food writers, of I mean, you could, I mean, I don't know. They didn't, you know, in like David Camp's United States of Arugula, they really trace it like the beginning of American gourmet food was women and gay men. And I don't, you know, it's a big part of the tradition.
It is a big part of the tradition. But those are also people that are sort of pushing culture to the forefront sometimes. Yes. So maybe it was in some of the precursors to Fashion Week that we have now we can thank for the modern food scene here in New York.
Yes.
But, you know, there is a rich history in New York. And I think a lot of times people in New York have traditionally been, I mean, this is the home of the gay rights movement. It all started here. So, I mean, New York has traditionally been more accepting of people and of different cultures. But I still really think that cooking is mostly about just being, you know, making great food. And that speaks for itself. And that's what people really care about.
Yeah, it is. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for being on the show with us. Feel free to stick around and eat some pizza.
Thanks for having me.
And Top Chef is on 10 o'clock every Wednesday.
It's on 10 o'clock every Wednesday night. You can also catch me this week on Watch What Happens Live with Andy Cohen following Top Chef at 11.
That show's doing gangbusters.
Gangbusters. Just went 5 nights a week starting this week. So.
Unbelievable. And what else? And Facebook, Twitter?
Facebook, Twitter. You can find me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have the new Kansas City. When can we expect that?
We're probably about a year out from that. I mean, permits and smokestacks and smokers and all of that. So, but we're working hard.
Well, if you need any taste testers, you just let us know. We'll come out. Tyler, thank you so much for being on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you very much.
This next track is one of my favorites from the end of last year. We have Pocket Vinyl coming up next. And this is The Gray Ship by EMA? Emma? I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyone? Anyone. All right. It's Gray Ship. Here we go on Snacky Tunes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
When you see that ship, it is the ship you can see. When the gray ship calls, it is a calling for me. I thought it would come from, I thought it would come from further north than that. Blue sky.
lived on the prairie, nothing and nothing and nothing and nothing. I got the same feeling inside of me, nothing and nothing and nothing and nothing.
All right. You were saying Emma? EMA?
I think it's EMA.
EMA.
Gray Ship.
Isn't it all capital letters?
Yeah.
Yeah. First track off the her last album. Did pretty well. So now in studio we have Pocket Vinyl, who is Eric and his wife Elizabeth. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
And the first two fans I've ever met.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No one else has come on who's like listened to the show before?
No. I think you're the first people who wrote us and were like, can we come on the show?
Really?
Yeah. So you two can be on this.
Awesome.
So tell us about your band. Who is Pocket Vinyl?
Basically just the two of us. It's sort of evolved from another band I had with a few other guys, but long story short, they couldn't tour. Mm. And last summer, in 2010, I was, so I guess, is that 2 summers ago now? I don't know. But in 2010, went on our first tour, and while I was planning it, I was originally going to go by myself. Mm-hmm. But then Elizabeth and I started dating, and we came up with the idea of like her painting on stage while I played the piano.
Yeah, I don't do anything musical. Nope. I mean, I'm a painter, and so we figured we'll bring that in.
You say woo in one song.
I say woo in one song, that's it.
Besides that, though, she doesn't really. We've been actually trying to think of different ways to kind of bring her in.
Like, maybe play a cymbal or try to learn harmonica
with the paintbrushes or
something. Yeah.
Triangle.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be sweet if she learned to tap dance and paint at the same time to keep percussion?
So are it's you paint on stage, and is it a new painting with every song or every performance? Like, how many paintings do you put out during one episode?
During each performance, I do one full painting. We play for about 45 minutes, and so I can do like a full size painting in that amount of time. It's a different one each time.
Do you practice?
No, but I mean, I do commissions, so I guess you can kind of call me working on commissions at home as practice, but no, not really.
She's drawn her whole life. She's always practicing.
And how did you two meet?
College, basically.
Yeah.
Which where'd you go?
Houghton College. It's a small college. Yeah.
it's about an hour from Rochester.
Okay.
Yeah, an hour south of that.
Okay.
And, I grew up actually in the town of Houghton. It's a very, there's less than 1,000 people in the town. And the college comprised of about 1,200 students. So the town more than doubles when school's in session.
Wow.
And, yeah, I grew up there.
I bet
there's
some natives in Houghton who just hate that.
Doesn't everybody work for the college?
There's a lot of friends of mine and stuff who, yeah, like when we finished high school, they were like, I'm never coming to Houghton again. And even sometimes they'll go out to a different college, but then come back and work at Houghton College after they graduate.
It happens. People are drawn to where they're from.
Yeah. Small towns.
Well, but then again, too, I have a lot of friends who hate Houghton, never want to go back. Who like I grew up there with me, and I don't know. I'm at peace with it. I like it.
You're at peace with it?
Yeah, yeah.
And you grew up in a small town as well, right?
Yeah, a really small town, way up in northern Quebec.
Like how north?
North.
Well, like from here, you have to drive for 2 days, and then you have to take a train for 12 hours.
All north, like all always.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah.
You drive 2 days and then a 12-hour train.
That's right. So it takes 3 days just to get there.
Why can't you just drive on? There are no roads?
No, there's no roads.
The only way to get to the town is by train or plane.
Yeah.
Huh.
And even plane is like a...
Dicey?
10, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like a 10-person
cargo plane. It's a plane like smaller than the studio, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. So did you want to get out as well?
I did as a high schooler. You know, like I left when I was in high school. But I ended up going back. I taught art at the local high school there last year, and it's the kind of place where I feel like while you're there, you're kind of like you want to get out, you want to get back to civilization. But like now, I miss it. I miss the people. Like you build some really good relationships with the people that are there because it's so small.
Yeah,
especially the kids too.
Yeah, because the kids, my students that I had last year, like I miss them a lot.
Well, I bet you they miss you.
Yeah.
Did you teach them painting?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's great. All right, let's get a song.
Okay.
Your song. What are you going to play first?
I think the song is called I Am Not Japan. Actually, it is called I Am Not Japan.
I
was still... we were debating earlier which songs to play when.
Okay.
Because we're very familiar with the Snacky Tunes outlay.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate
it.
And so, this is called I Am Not Japan.
Awesome.
go through. Yeah. Touching back, making a sound. Keys in my saddlebags, they're moving around. The doors are all locked from above, and they won't let me see the face of who I'm thinking of. All the food's not the best here. Saw so much of something I didn't know I'd love to see. Have you always been this soft to where you cannot help but love? Oh, you're forming some rift or some spiritual gift. Can I but turn your heart off? Starting to turn. It's not time now when I get home, but the morning light's probably peeking through your window. Have you always been this soft to where you cannot help but love? Oh, you're forming some rift or some spiritual gift. Can I but turn your heart?
Awesome. Nice. Very nice. Very nice. So, what type of paintings are inspired by this type of music?
I like to call them abstract figurative. Because they, I mean, they always have like some kind of something. You can tell what it, like it's some birds, or if there's like a kid in the painting or something. But it's, you know, it's not realistic at all. I like to use a lot of bright colors. I use oil paints too.
Mm-hmm. It's always interesting. I always like to note how, because I got a front row seat for all her paintings, which I am so blessed with. But she'll go through different like phases. Like there was one week this last December where, for about 6 or 7 shows, she was kind of doing a, it almost looked like stained glass windows type things. And then there was another with like a lot of different birds and stuff. There was another week where she was focusing on like deer and trees, like. And it's really interesting. Like recently, she's been kind of doing actually more like human like faces and forms and stuff, which she hasn't really done before. And so it's always interesting to see if like how they, pretty much how she'll take an idea and then explore it for a few shows, and then like pick up another idea and keep working off that.
And what did you do with the paintings afterwards?
We silent auction them at every show. So yeah, we'll have like a notebook in the back and people just write their name, write a bid. And so, I mean, paintings can go from anywhere from, you know, $10 to a couple hundred, depending on where we are. And that's actually how we're able to, this is our full-time job.
Oh yeah.
And that's how we're able to keep this as our full-time job, is that we sell the paintings at every show.
I don't know how bands tour without a painter, because that is just an income that I don't understand how people can survive on the road without that, like at this level.
Is it just the two of you on tour?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
We do everything ourselves in terms of like booking and travel and all that.
And we tour in a Camry. We don't have like
2000.
We just took the back seats out, put the piano in.
Yeah, we have no back seats because we couldn't put it down far enough to fit this like huge piano in, and so we just had to take them out. So like, there's even been times where after shows, people are like, "Oh yeah, let's all go. Like, we can stay at my place." And oh, we walked, but like, can we get a ride with you? And it's like, no, sorry.
No, sorry.
We have no other seats in the car besides for the two of us.
So let's talk about the album.
Yeah.
What was your process putting together the album? Now, were you involved at all, even though you're painting? Or like, is it just, do you just write all the songs?
Yeah. Well, basically, as like the song you just heard, I kind of formed that all throughout. I formed the lyrics and words and music all by myself, mm-hmm. and I kind of take those piano, skeletons or whatever, which, I mean, they compromise of our live show, but I have a friend who is a producer, who he's all our albums, he's produced and everything. His name is John Butine, and I take him to him, and we have another friend who's a drummer. John Butine is also a bassist. And we know a few other musicians and stuff, and we kind of add everything to it. Okay. So our records are all, like the first song on the show, Quiet Epiphany, is that has like full orchestration.
Right.
We're able to, yeah. And so, it's a lot of that's just bred in the studio. And we just, we just released our second album. Our first album took about 3 years to write and everything and get all of that, just due to a lot of different factors. But this last one we did in 2 weeks in June, which, had like all the songs we're playing today and stuff are off, but that was a much quicker process. I'm used to like writing a song, sitting on it for like 2 years, then recording it, and it's still a little scary that this new album is out, even though it was released in September. I'm still like not sure how I feel about it. Like, I like the songs,
really?
I like the songs and everything, but you have to. I mean, our first album, by the time we released it, it was so, I feel like, watertight to what we wanted, because it took like 3 years,
right,
just because of college and job,
right.
And this last one we busted out in 2 weeks. And so even though I had all the songs beforehand and I felt good about them, the orchestration and everything, I'm still like, oh, will I hate this in a year?
I think it's good.
Yeah, no, I like it, and I still like it. I'm just worried that, you know, you ever do something and you hate it like after a while? And you're like,
yeah,
oh, that was
well,
good,
I mean, but this is, I think we can all attest to that, that sometimes you just got that shit out the door.
Right, yeah.
Like, and that's, I think, one of the things I like about Top Chef as well, is that, like, you have 3 hours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
Or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think, I think with anything, you know, I've worked with people who are some of the most creative people in the world, but they're never done with anything. And unfortunately, with commerce and things like that, that you eventually need a product at some level. And it's great. If you want to sit around and work on an album for 15 years, that's fantastic, but that's not gonna do anything for you.
Oh, definitely. And plus, the thing is, too, is our first album, we were able to do for free.
Yeah.
And the last one we had to pay for studio time, so that also helped the 2 weeks as opposed to
but,
3 years.
But, you know, aren't so many of your paintings, I mean, how many, what's the percentage of paintings you feel like I finished something completely at the end of painting it?
for the ones that I do for the show, I feel like I have to. I have to be done with it because I mean, it's the same way in that, like, as soon as the music starts, I have to start painting. I can't stand there and think about it. And so at the end of the show, I have to be done. And I guess I've just kind of conditioned myself to be like, this is done. I'm happy with it. It's good. And yeah, I'm pretty satisfied with a 45-minute painting.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get another song since we only have an hour.
All right.
What's the next song?
This is called Sunday Best.
Okay. Here we go. Pocket Vinyl live on Snacky Tunes.
Blind, and I listened for a shortcut when you were behind. I listened for an orchestra when you were deaf, and I listened for faith when you had none left. I listened for the sunrise. Sunday best, and I listen for a treasure deep within the chest. I listen to my piano, oh, at such a young age, and I listen to my lover sing words on this stage. I listen for the scissors that cut up my arm, and I listen for depression with all of its charm. I listen for an outlet to help me cope, and I listen for death, but heard only.
Awesome. Well done. Little harmonica. That was a little Randy Newman-esque.
Yeah, it was actually, it's me trying to rip off Tom Waits, actually.
Okay.
without the voice, obviously, but.
But yeah. No, yeah. I mean, you got your own voice. You hit that note.
Did I? Okay, yeah. Good. I can't hear myself well in these headphones, but it's, thank you. Good. I'm glad to hear that after the fact.
Since it's the two of you on the road, and it seems like you guys have a little green in your pocket, what's eating on the road like for you two?
We actually don't have too much in our pockets. I have a lot of college loans right now.
Okay.
And so food is dry cereal a lot of the time.
Yeah. You know, we do,
fruit here and there where we can get it.
We're pretty much kings at finding like low budget. I love touring Pennsylvania because we stop at Amish stores, and you can get like 7 apples for $1.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Oh man.
I mean, if we ever do get food, like buy food and eat out, it's usually we try to go for local diners. I love local diners.
Oh yeah.
You know,
Brinner,
just getting,
man.
Like breakfast food,
no matter what time of the day.
Yeah, it's good. I think a lot of high school. Was 2 eggs, rye toast, and coffee.
Yeah.
$2.95. That's a shout out to Lanark Diner in Lanark, PA. You know, it's too bad because the diner scene in Brooklyn's pretty, in Williamsburg's pretty sad. They have Kellogg's, I will go on record and say I get sick every time I eat there.
Oh, really? No.
And I won't go eat there.
No.
Really?
It looks good. It's got everything right except for the food.
Is it all like got the shiny, you know, 50s,
and they redid it, and it's got neon. I mean, it's like
fancy.
Plucked out of New Jersey. Plopped right in Williamsburg. I don't know what they do that makes it so bad.
Yeah, I won't go there. So.
No. What's the Connecticut diner scene like? Good?
Man.
Like we said, we're not big Connecticut fans.
Yeah, so it's...
We don't spend much time there. We're on the road most of the time.
Yeah. I mean, we're from Connecticut because due to cheap housing options
that we
had.
We live in like a community house with my brother and a couple other people.
Yeah. We're so thankful for that because without that, I don't think we could afford a tour. But... yeah, it's Connecticut. I don't know what scenes are in Connecticut, but there's not. I don't know. Maybe the people from, and I don't mean to bash.
I mean the hardcore scene was.
Yeah,
pretty
the hardcore.
Yeah,
scene,
there's yeah.
There's but, a big hardcore scene, and then I don't know. I mean, when the Wailers used to be there,
there is this one place we haven't checked out yet, but it's called like Butch's Diner.
Butch's Breakfast Club.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it's like a place. You know, like you can't smoke inside in Connecticut, but. If you go in this place...
You, like, sign the book, make yourself part of the club, and you can, like, smoke in the club
and
stuff.
I mean, there's some places in
That's
New
supposed
Haven
to be good, but...
have, like, the original hamburger.
Yeah.
Whatever the place... That has the upright griddles and things like that.
The upright griddle, yep.
And Toad's, which is, like, a concert venue place. And then Yale. But, like, I mean, it's...
I tell you what are, though. Yeah. On the road, our, like, big foodie type thing is beer. We consider ourselves like beer connoisseurs.
Oh really?
Oh, I love
like every place we go to. They give us like 2 or 3 free drinks, right? And
yeah.
So we're drinking every single night.
And they always have at least something.
Always
local.
Try to drink something local.
Well, that's like, I mean that's really the way to do it because I don't see any point in just having the Stella on tap.
Oh, definitely
not. No. And we're pretty like I have actually never had a Pabst Blue Ribbon, and it was kind
of
I haven't. And it's to the point now, like when I realized that, I was like, well, I'm just going to see how long I can go now.
You know, not the worst beer in the world. Not the worst.
No. I don't know. I can't judge. I've never had it. I've heard things, but you know, I'm not.
You know, Tyler, before I forget, I forgot to ask you, what do you listen to when you cook?
Music? Music-wise?
Yeah.
Usually nothing. I'm very quiet in the kitchen, but living in Seattle for many years, I always had 90.3 KEXP on.
KEXP.
Yes,
love them.
I love KEXP.
Inspiration for all internet radio stations.
Yes.
So, Pacavana, what's coming up next? More tours? Road Warriors?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. It's January is mostly touring. Tonight we're playing at Goodbye Blue Monday, which is somewhere in Brooklyn here.
Down on Broadway.
Yeah. And then we're also playing on Saturday, we're playing at Pianos at 7:30.
Love it.
I think we're playing at 9 tonight.
Do you get to add an extra S since you're bringing your own?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
I'll
talk to the management.
If you're
about it.
in the mood for getting drunk, try those frozen margaritas because they are dangerous.
Trouble.
They are trouble.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone who's had a couple of those, they have good food though at Pianos.
Okay.
And I think
I've known a few good bands who've like played it, and so it's another kind of thing where we're like,
oh, I've spent many a times at Pianos back in the early 2000s when Lower East Side was
good
hopping.
Beer selection.
You've been
too.
There too?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good. I hope they give us some.
Pianos
on the house.
Was like the one of like the epicenters, like them and Max Fish, and the Dark Room for like the Lower East Side revival in like the early 2000s.
What about? Did you ever go to Arlene's Grocery?
Not
is that,
really.
Is that? I was
like,
I had the impression that that's like a good
it,
venue.
It
but...
is, but like it's. I'm not part of. I was never part of that scene.
Okay.
Like I was
we
never part
once.
Of like live karaoke, and I was never. It was like sort of metal, sort of punk rock, and I just was more of the like.
All right, I can see that.
I don't know.
That makes sense.
But I mean, it does. You know, it only ever popped up on my radar during like CMJ.
All right.
And are you guys going to South by this year?
We
just applied.
Yeah, we just applied for one of them. There was like a late thing. I forget the name of the showcase, but we applied for it. I'm hoping
it's like for the indie. and apply.
Yeah, I'm hoping the piano thing or the painting thing gets us in, because that actually, just having the painter, that has gotten us so many more opportunities, just because it's like a, you know, unique thing.
And, well, you know, it's all these days, it's about juxtaposition. Yeah. And organic juxtaposition that isn't just like, oh, we did this.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. You know, and that's actually, I was a little worried about that at first when we started. Like, I'm afraid people are going to think we're like,
gimmicky.
I
don't know.
Yeah, gimmicky. But I think we're far past that, and we've proved that there's a lot more depth to the show.
I think it works.
Yeah.
And do you do all the artwork for the CDs?
Yeah, all the CDs, T-shirts, everything.
I assume. I just had to ask. Yeah. awesome so much. So pocketvinyl.bandcamp.com.
Mm-hmm.
Pocketvinyl.com.
Yeah, pocketvinyl.com is the main.
And Twitter is
pocketvinyl. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter,
I've heard of all those things.
The Googleability is fantastic.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's
unless
it's
you're looking for pocket protectors. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So thank you guys so much. Tyler, thank you so much. We are on the countdown to 100 episodes. We got two more episodes.
Yeah, that's right.
So next week, I forget who it's going to be for 99. but for 100, it's going to be pretty special. I don't want to say yet, because I feel like every time we announce people are going to be in the show, then something happens. But yeah, so if any of you listeners out there want to send in questions or comments or anything for our 100th episode, let us know you are out there. But we're going to have one last song from Pocket Vinyl. All
right.
What's the last song?
This is called A Little Joke.
Okay, great. Well, it's a pleasure having you all here. Thanks so much. And we will check with you next week. Thanks for listening to Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.com.
Perhaps there is something I'm missing, but I don't think that I endure as much as you claim. I don't think she is lying to my face, and her actions are a dead giveaway to how she thinks. It's an honest mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen again. Oh, it's an honest mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen again. Oh, it's an honest mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen again. Oh, it's an honest mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen again. Understand. Well, I'm confused, 'cause you're still clinking glasses, and beer spills on both sides of your mouth and onto your shirt. I can't tell, I can't read, I can't spell, I can't see if there's a scam mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen again. Oh, it's an honest mistake, and I'm sure it won't happen. I'm tearing down the only fulcrum that connects our speaking routes. But a little joke about their faith is good for some devout. Impress a king. But a little joke about our nature, what's another?